All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James. This is Yahweh's Covenant People. I've been trying to load up the TalkShoe program, and the page only half loads up and then disappears, so I may not be able to get the TalkShoe page running this evening. I'll keep trying to do that, but I can certainly do the show on Eurofolk Radio. We're live now on Eurofolk Radio. And perhaps if there's somebody listening to me on Eurofolk Radio that has been able to access the chat room, tell everybody I'm having problems getting the chat room loaded, and they should just tune in to Eurofolk Radio for the live presentation. And so I'm going to basically going to complete my series on the Parthians here. The Parthians, part four, although this will deal, number one, with Serena the Parthian. And this is from the Anglo-Saxon Israel website. And then we're going to go to tracing the dispersion, talking about the origin of the German language in the dispersion of the Parthians and Scythians. And that, again, the title of that is Tracing the Dispersion by Terry Blodgett. So I'm just going to quickly go through Serena the Parthian, which is from Wikipedia, so you can just type in to your browser Serena, that's S-U-R-E-N-A, the Parthian, at Wikipedia, and you will get a bronze statue showing that he clearly is a white man with a mustache. Serena, 84 to 52 BC, also spelt Sorina with an O, is the most common appellation for Iran Spabad Rustaham Serena Pahlav, son of Arash, Persian, and Masis. Serena was born into the Surin Pahlav clan. Remember I told you last time that the Pahlavi dialect of Aramaic is the true source of the German language. The name under which he appears in the Western classical sources was apparently no more than his hereditary title, that of Surin, S-U-R-E-N, which appears again in the Sassanid period. And I'm going to try to split screen here so I can, okay, it's asking me to join. I'm going to try to do it really quickly here. Don't want to interrupt the broadcast, but we'll see what happens. See if the chat, the dialogue page opens up here. And I'm going to try to type it. It's trying. It's trying to open up. I'll stay with it until it finally does open up. But I'll continue here with this discussion of, okay, I have to scroll down, the various sections here on this Wikipedia page regarding Serena the Parthian. The great general, the name Serena is preserved amongst the tales of epic heroes whose deeds are recalled in the Kayanian section of the Shahnameh. In this Iranian national epic, the record of the Arsacids was suppressed at its true chronological point. The instance of Gotars or Gudars, you can see some of the what we would call Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, even a British Welsh names, Gudars or Gotars, Gudars, and like Guinevere. A lot of these names are actually coming from Parthia. And I can see it's just not loading up, so I'm not going to be able to do the TalkShoe portion of today's show. I'll just continue here. It has shown that at least some of its spectacular episodes were transferred to the legendary period of Kayavus and incorporated there. The feat of arms performed by Serena was certainly the most celebrated of the whole Ashkanian, Arsacid, Parthian era and did not vanish entirely. Thus, in some ways, the position of the great Suren in the historical tradition is curiously parallel to that of Rustam, the hero of the Shahnameh. His figure was endowed with many features of the historical personality of Rustam. The latter was always represented as the mightiest of Iranian paladins, and the atmosphere of the episodes in which he features is strongly reminiscent of the Ashkanian period. Serena commanded the Parthian army under Orodes at the dynastic succession battle of Seleucia in 55 BC, soundly trouncing a mixed army bolstered by Roman legions for the unsuccessful Mithridates III. So here I think we get a clue as to why the Parthian Empire began to disintegrate, because we see two factions of Parthia, one siding with Rome and the other siding against other Parthians or against Persians. So what we see, whenever one group of our people sides with the enemy, that means you're going to have a quick demise of the nation. Okay, you can see that obviously, well, not in every case, but in some cases, the invading army either threatens one province or bribes them, or there's a traitor involved who gets the nation, one province, to fight with the invading army against the indigenous people. Any one of these could have been the case here with Mithridates III, who was a claimant to the throne of Parthia, and who he was supported by Aulus Gabinius, Roman governor of Syria. The next year, the Romans, in a hopeless attempt in 54 BC, attacked western Iranian provinces in which both armies met at Haran. Iranians, under the command of Serena, destroyed entire Roman forces, and 20,000 Romans were killed. 10,000 were captured and deported to distant northern provinces of Margiana for hard labor and slavery. After that event, the Euphrates River was firmly established as the boundary between the Parthian and Roman empires, though the debacles seemed to little affect the career of the influential Aulus Gabinius. Now here, this is very important here. So in 54 BC, this sound defeat of the Romans by Serena was the cause of the peace treaty between Rome and Parthia that enabled Palestine, that is Judea, to be in a state of peace where the Messiah could come. Otherwise, you'd have invading armies, Romans and Parthians. There'd be constant war, and it would upset the trade and the social life of Jerusalem tremendously. So this era of peace, which was established around 54 BC, was very crucial for the events of the Messiah to transpire, and certainly enabled the Parthian Magi to travel to Judea to worship what they knew to be the Messiah. So without this peace treaty after 54 BC, none of this would have been able to, and we certainly wouldn't have had a story of the Magi, the story of Christ, had he been born during a war between the Romans and the Parthians. It would have been a very different story. It would have been very chaotic. In any case, let's continue here. The achievements of General Serena and his popularity among Iranians caused his sovereign fear of his throne, and soon after Kare, King Orodos II had him executed. So anyway, so because he was very good in battle, the king feared him, his own king feared him. The bitterness between the Suren Pahlav clan and their cousins, the ruling house of Arsaces, made Surens to assist Ardashir I, the founder of the Sasanian dynasty, to overthrow the last Arsacid dynasty king, Artabanus IV. So here we see the internal strife of the Arsacid / Parthian / Scythian people now today known primarily as the Iranians. And even today you will see among the Iranians lots of Aryan people, although they've mixed a lot with Arabs. The fact is the Iranian state is much whiter than the surrounding Arab countries, and the Iranians do not appreciate being referred to as Arabs. They do not consider themselves to be Arabs. Although you can see, even though there's a lot of white faces and many people who look very white, you can see it's still a mixed race country. So, but in the days of the Parthians and the Scythians and the Sakae, it was white. It was, and the Persians as well. It was pure white. Plutarch, in his Life of Crassus, describes Serena as, "Serena was an extremely distinguished man in wealth, birth, and in the honor paid to him, he ranked next after the king. In courage and ability, he was the foremost Parthian of his time. And in stature and personal beauty, he had no equal." He was white. "When he traveled about the country on his own affairs, he was always accompanied by a baggage train of 1,000 dromedaries. 200 wagons carried his harem, 1,000 armored cavalry, and still more light armed cavalry acted as his escort. The total number of this cavalry, his vassals, and his slaves came to at least 100,000 men. He had, as an ancient privilege of his family, the right to be the first to set the crown on the head of the king of Parthia at the coronation. Unfortunately, he was killed by the reigning king, so he couldn't do that." So, again, as I mentioned in the Pagan Origin of Christmas series, the Parthians, it wasn't just three or four Parthians. They had to be traveling with an entire entourage of camels and horses if they could stand the trip, depending whether they go through the desert or they follow the Mesopotamian rivers. So what we're seeing here is the enormity of the Parthian Empire and how one lesser king, namely Serena, could command 100,000 men and have a traveling train of 1,000 dromedaries, that is camels, and with 200 wagons carrying his harem. I can imagine the other wagons that are carrying really important stuff. So this is very interesting. And one more comment here. Iran, they spell it E-R-A-N here. Iran Spabod, Rustaham's youngest son, Rustaham Gandofar Suran Pallav. See, we're getting traces of Welsh and Celtiberian here, or simply Gandoferus, the ruler of the eastern Greater Iran, who ruled between 10 BC and AD 17 on the vast empire of the Saka. Who are the Saka? They're the descendants of Isaac. At the time of the Ashkanian dynasty, seems to have been the founder of the Indo-Parthian kingdom and the king of India. In the Acts, I told you all these people were related. Acts of St. Thomas, in the Acts of St. Thomas, he appears as Gaspar or Casper, Persian Jasper, among the three magi, which was inserted in a biblical story after their visit to Bethlehem. Here we see again more proof that the Parthians, Sakae, Scythians, Cimmerians, etc. were in fact Israelites. Now I'm going to switch to tracing the dispersion. And this article can be found at anglo-saxonisrael.com, Tracing the Dispersion. And it's toward the bottom on the left-hand column on the home page. Or you can just do a search in the box, Tracing, and put the entire title, Tracing the Dispersion, and the search box will find it for you. And I'm going with an introduction by yours truly. Introduction entitled Hebrew Influence on the German Language. It has been apparent to me that the modern European languages were and are heavily influenced by the Hebrew language. When I first stated this proposition in a 2003 radio interview with Pastor Dan Johns, I immediately received hate mail from certain linguists, both Judeo-Christian and secular, who claimed that such an idea is outside the realm of possibility, since, quote, everyone knows that Hebrew is not an Indo-European language, unquote. In fact, my foot-thick Webster's New 20th Century Dictionary, second edition, which I still have, and is still a foot thick, in the opening two-page frontispiece, is a drawing of the Indo-European family of languages, depicted as a tree, with Indo-European as the ground and the various European languages depicted on the branches of this tree. Well, amazingly, Hebrew is not listed in this tree of languages. This exclusion shows how seriously defective the art of modern linguistics is today. The modern theories of the linguistic departments of academia are divorced from reality. They entertain the highly suspect notion that language evolves in a kind of evolutionary progression, irrespective of the people who take their language with them. Okay, you find these dialects of Hebrew and Aramaic arriving in Europe with the people who formerly spoke those languages, and they gradually changed because they adopted new terms as they migrated, sometimes merging with other Israelite tribes or with Scythian, in this case would have been Japhetic tribes, who would have spoken a slightly different language. And so you get all these dialects forming as the Israelites migrate from Parthia and Armenia across the Caucasus Mountains and then around the Sea of Azov and other seas, other territories. Some of them went west by ship, settled in Greece, others settled in Italy, some in Spain, and some even as far as Ireland and Wales, because the Welsh referred to themselves as the Cymru, which is a version of Cimmerian, namely King Omri. It's a reference to King Omri of Israel. So whenever you see the term Cimmerian, you know it's a reference to Israelites because it's taken directly from the name of King Omri. All right, so this idea of the migratory evolution of language is what I have proposed, which is opposed to the standard textbook idea that language just evolves on its own. I found, in reality, language tends to stay the same in places where the people don't move. And, you know, they pick up words here and there from maybe visitors and from traders. But ordinarily, the language, unless the population moves a great deal, stays the same. The very first tribe to be exiled from Israel was half the tribe of Manasseh, the half that lived on the east side of the Jordan River. This occurred in the year 745 BC. Since I was aware that the Caucasian people are the literal descendants of the exiled tribes of Israel, I knew that these people had to have brought their Hebrew language with them, at least to a partial extent. Virtually all of the 10 northern tribes were taken captive by the year 721 BC, thus placing them all in the area then known as Media, immediately south of the Caucasus mountain range. All of our modern history books tell us that the origin of the Caucasian people is some unsolvable mystery. Quote, no one knows where they came from, unquote, they say with palms up in the air. I beg to differ. As these Israelites moved into Europe and merged with the existing Celtic people, remember the Celtic people were part of the first wave of Israelites under Zerahemnah that had left Egypt circa 1500 BC, and they founded Troy, they founded Italy, and I'm sure many of them moved north into what's called the Celtic areas in modern Germany, across the Tyrol, and some of them went to France, actually. some of them to Spain, which was originally known as Iberia, land of the Hebrews. Some of them obviously went to Ireland, because the Prince of the Scarlet Thread was none other than Zarahemla, and the string tied around the wrist of Zarahemla is commemorated in the Irish flag, the Red Hand of Ulster, and some of them wound up in England as well. So this would be your Celtic, your earliest wave of Israelite emigration, primarily coming from Egypt, where the Israelites were held as slaves by the Egyptians, of course. So we have this Celtic language, which is Hebrew, which is based on Hebrew, because it's even referred to as Hamito-Semitic by the linguists, which means the same. It's a language spoken by Ham and Shem, the two brothers, the sons of Noah. So Hamito-Semitic and Hebrew are virtually identical. Okay, again, we're talking about different dialects, words that people pick up from their neighborhood, words they make up, etc., etc., as they travel around. And of course, the Israelites were known to travel a lot. Okay, all right, so that's the Celtic wing, and then the Cimmerian wave occurred around the time of the Phoenicians, before 745 BC, when a lot of the Israelites saw the handwriting on the wall that the Assyrians were getting ready to attack, deport, and enslave the entire 10 northern tribes. And so many of them left in ships. They're the ones, Cimmerians, they're named after King Omri. And the Welsh were certainly part of this migration. And then the third and final wave of migration is the Caucasian Germanic migration across the Caucasus Mountains. And that migration was strictly by land, over land, using the rivers of Europe. And the Germans were the last wave, the last part of this third wave to leave, and I covered that extensively in terms of their migration. So Mr. Blodgett here now analyzes the language, the German language, with respect to Hebrew. Tracing the Dispersion by Terry M. Blodgett. New linguistic studies help tell us about the scattering of Israel. And this was, I think, also reprinted in Ensign, February 1994. What befell the tribes of Israel? And I do have an actual print copy of the manuscript. This was a manuscript, I think it was his master's or possibly doctorate thesis. And I have a copy of the original thesis in my library. What befell the tribes of Israel's northern kingdom many centuries ago? That question has been asked by students of the scriptures for generations. Like any important historical topic, it is one that deserves careful and thoughtful study. Reconstructing ancient history, even religious history, can be compared to putting together a large, complex puzzle with many of the pieces missing. One must locate and assemble as many pieces as possible, then form as accurate a picture of the past as the facts allow. In tracing Israel's dispersion, therefore, many pieces may be considered: artifacts, vestiges of ancient customs, archaeology, cultural anthropology, and scriptural and historical accounts. This article explores only one such piece, that of linguistic evidence. He says, next, every language evolves. Language is a dynamic cultural phenomenon. It changes and grows. In our day, modern technology, the sciences, and the media have accelerated the acquisition of new words, but at the same time have standardized spelling and pronunciation. In the past, languages acquired new words more slowly, but they were more likely to experience spelling and pronunciation changes. Some of these changes took only decades. Others took centuries. One of the major sources of language change occurs when two groups of people, each speaking a different language, come in contact with one another. Each language influences the other, becoming a catalyst for change and eventually settling into patterns characteristic of the languages prompting the changes. These patterns serve as clues to help a linguist determine what the language was like before the changes took place and which languages caused the changes. In other words, if you have a dominant culture and it would retain most of its language and simply pick up parts of the subculture that was either invading or joining into it. He continues, "The basic conclusion of linguistic study into this subject is that as large groups of ancient Israelites left their homeland, first following the Assyrian captivity of northern Israel about 700 BC, and the Babylonian captivity of Judah in the south about 600 BC, and second, following the Roman conquest of Palestine about 70 AD, their language influenced the languages of some of the countries to which they migrated. This linguistic evidence can help us determine where some of these Israelites went and approximately when. Although ancient Israelites were eventually scattered throughout the entire world, see Amos 9:9, at least one general geographical area contains significant linguistic evidence to suggest that Israelite migrations did in fact occur there. That area is Europe. Linguistic evidence in Europe. From the Old Testament and other historical sources, such as the Annals of the Assyrian Kings, we learn that the northern kingdom, after years of war and deportation, fell to Assyrian invaders in 721 BC. Jeremiah emphasized the north countries as being these Israelites' eventual destination. See Jeremiah 3, 12-18, Jeremiah 16, 14-16, and implied a western route. Thus, a natural place to look for what befell those remnants is to study the countries north and west of the Middle East. It is of interest, therefore, to learn that in Europe, the centuries following 700 BC were marked by tremendous outside influence, and language was profoundly affected. During the period between 700 and 400 BC, numerous languages in Europe underwent major pronunciation changes and absorbed a new vocabulary. This was particularly true of the Celtic languages, which were originally spoken throughout Europe from 700 BC to 300 BC. So this was before the emergence of the Caucasians. Now, as I mentioned, the Celts were already there. They'd been there since the first migration wave, or they were, let's say, the tail end of the first migration wave that began in 1500 BC, because obviously it would take them longer to move inland into Europe. And there may have been some Cimmerian Israelites, but I don't think so. I think it was mainly the Celtic wave. The Cimmerians seem to have gone straight west by sea, although there may have been some overland migration or shorter migrations as well. Okay, and he says that this was particularly true of the Celtic languages, which were originally spoken throughout Europe, but gradually became more concentrated in Western Europe and Britain, and of the Germanic languages, which were spoken in Central and Northern Europe and Scandinavia, and eventually in England. The gradual evolving of the sounds that make up words in a language, particularly when two languages merge, is known by linguists as a sound shift. So we're talking about a sound shift, two languages merging. Now, what are the two languages? Well, the Celtic Hebrew and the Germanic Hebrew, or Parthian Hebrew, or Aramaic. So we have the Celtic Hebrew, or Celtiberian, and the Parthian Aramaic, most properly called, most properly identified by those two terms. The sound shift. The well-known pronunciation changes of the period of time between 700 and 400 BC have been called the Germanic sound shift because they were the most pronounced and systematic in the German languages, which include English, Dutch, German, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, and Icelandic. Also, during the same time period, the total vocabulary in the German languages increased by as much as one-third. So they picked up new words and probably invented a few of their own. Linguists have long pondered what caused this sound shift and the increase in vocabulary. One theory is that the technologically advanced peoples who introduced iron to Europe, 7th century BC in Austria, 6th century BC in Sweden, we're talking about Aryans, Israelites, also influenced the language changes. Linguistic research supports this idea, as well as the idea that these advanced peoples came from the Middle East, where iron was in use. The research shows that the changes in language resulted from an influx of Hebrew-speaking people into Europe, particularly into the Germanic and Celtic-speaking areas. Let me repeat this statement, folks. Let me repeat this statement. The research shows that the changes in language resulted from an influx of Hebrew-speaking people into Europe, particularly into the Germanic and Celtic-speaking areas. This is the final wave, the Parthian wave of Israelites into Europe. Next heading, the Germanic sound shift. Most of the languages of Europe belong to the Indo-European family of languages. That is, they are part of the linguistically linked group of languages spoken in Europe and spreading as far east as Iran and India. For many years, the peculiarities in the Germanic languages kept linguists from recognizing that the Germanic languages belong to the Indo-European group. However, early in the 19th century, two linguists, Rasmus Rask from Denmark, 1818, and Jacob Grimm from Germany, I think he was one of the Grimm brothers of the Grimm's fairy tales, 1819-22, maybe he's not sure of the exact date of birth, showed that the Germanic languages were indeed part of the Indo-European family, but that their differences in pronunciation were caused by a systematic shift in the sound of two groups of consonants. That is, the first group of consonants, P, T, K, and B, D, G. At the time of the sound shift, the pronunciation of these six consonants was changed to PH, TH, and KH, and BH, D, DH, and GH, respectively. These new sounds were usually represented in writing by the letters F, TH, H, or sometimes X or CH, and the B by V, and the D by TH, and the G by GH, I guess in zh. For example, by applying the rules of the sound shift to the Indo-European te puk, replacing the T, P, and K with TH, F, and X, we recognize the English words the fox. Very interesting. So, in Parthia, it would have been pronounced tepuk, but in English, it becomes the fox. Now, the relationship between the Indo-European word pater and the English word father becomes more recognizable. Okay, so the P is replaced by an F. Linguists generally agree that these changes began taking place sometime after 700 BC. And that the influence causing the sound shift continued to affect the Germanic dialects for several centuries, at least until 400 BC, and possibly as late as the Christian era. Unfortunately, scholars have not been able to agree upon what caused these changes, or where the original homeland of the peoples may have been. Scholars have traced them to the Black Sea area. Well, we're getting closer and closer to ancient Israel, are we not? Okay, remember I told you dialects travel with the people? They don't just evolve by themselves. Okay, so linguists generally agree that these changes began taking place around sometime after 700 BC. Unfortunately, scholars have not been able to agree upon what caused these changes or where the original homeland of the peoples may have been. Black Sea area is one of the places, and to the Caucasus Mountains. They were getting closer and closer, but research did not trace them beyond there because the scholars did not know whether that had been the people's first homeland or whether they had come from the east or south of that point. My research took me to the Middle East, and it was there that I found a likely cause for the sound shift, the Hebrew language. He continues. The first thing I noticed was that Hebrew shifted the same six consonants that were shifted in the Germanic, PTK and BDG. In ancient Hebrew, these consonants carried a dual pronunciation. Often they did not shift, but when they began a syllable that was preceded by a long vowel or ended a syllable, then PTK and BDG shifted to the sounds PH, the, TH, and K, and BH, DH, and GH. So there was a literally pronounced change in the pronunciation of the words or the letters, and certainly, of course, the words that included these letters. Thus, the Hebrew word for Spain, Sepharad, was pronounced Sepharad with an H at the end. And there, I don't know if I can pronounce the difference between a D and a DH, but hard to say. And the word for sign, spelled O-T, was pronounced O-T-H, or oath. So it's pretty evident because the Germanic does not have the T-H sound. Anybody who's been raised speaking the Germanic language, or many other languages for that matter, into adulthood have great difficulty pronouncing the T-H sound that's so common in English. In 700 BC, this sound shift was still functional in Hebrew and would have been part of any impact that migrating Israelites would have had on other languages. The fact that the same consonants were involved in similar sound shifts in both Hebrew and Germanic dialects at about the same time is significant. Yet even more significant is that the sounds PH, TH, and KH, and BH, DH, and GH, so prevalent in Hebrew, did not exist in Germanic before the sound shift occurred. So it's very obvious what Mr. Blodgett is saying, that somehow Hebrew influenced the Indo-Aryan languages. And as I've been telling you, Hebrew is an Indo-Aryan language. He's just showing us the connection. Next heading, a comparison of Hebrew and Germanic. The case for a Hebrew influence on Germanic is further strengthened by a close comparison of the two languages, and particularly of the changes that developed in Germanic following the Assyrian captivity of Israel. This is getting interesting. The changes fall generally into three categories: pronunciation, grammar, and vocabulary. Number one, pronunciation. In addition to the similar sound shifts just described, there were other sounds common to both Hebrew and Germanic that did not generally appear in the Indo-European languages. For example, when Hebrew and Germanic consonants appeared between vowels, they normally doubled if the preceding vowel was short. Okay, here's one of your rules of languages. So a short vowel like a as opposed to a. So if the consonants followed the short sound, you would have a doubling of the consonants. So instead of A-G, it would be A-G-G. This doubling of consonants, referred to as gemination, became a characteristic feature of Germanic, but not of the other Indo-European languages. In this way, Indo-European Media became the Old English middle, M-I-D-D-E-L, and ultimately the modern English middle, M-I-D-D-L-E. So you can see the connection here between Media, Indo-European, Old English, that is Germanic, middle, and of course the German is pronounced Mittel, M-I-T-T-E-L. So you can see the relationship. So this follows the sound shift coming from the Hebrew, the doubling of letters of consonants between vowels. He continues, almost half of the Hebrew verb conjugations required doubling the consonant and substituting a shortened vowel preceding the consonant. Compare Hebrew shabar to break and the related Hebrew form shibur S-H-I-B-B-E-R, to shatter. Likewise, almost half of the Germanic verbs doubled the middle consonant and substituted a shortened preceding vowel. Why? Because that was the habit they brought with them from the Hebrew. Indo-European sad and bad had become satan, or set, and bidda with two T's, and bidan with two D's, bid in Old English. Number two, grammar. At the time of the Germanic sound shift, the Germanic dialects experienced a sharp reduction in their number of grammatical cases, making Germanic more like Hebrew. So, the Germanic being an Indo-Aryan language coming from Aramaean, originally from the Pahlavi dialect of Iran, which what is today known as Iran, but which then was Scythia and or Parthia, which makes the Germanic more like Hebrew. As in English, the case or form of a noun, pronoun, or adjective in a Germanic language indicated its grammatical relation to other words in a sentence. At the time of the Germanic sound shift, the Germanic dialects immediately reduced the number of possible cases for a word from 8 to 4, as in modern German, and eventually to 3, as in English, Spanish, and French. These were the same 3 cases, with possible remnants of a 4th, that Hebrew used before the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. The nominative case, indicating a word as a subject of a sentence. The accusative case, indicating a word as the object of a verb or preposition. And genitive case, used to indicate a word in the possessive form. So nominative would be your basic form of the noun, and it is, let's say, horse. Accusative case, meaning object of a verb or preposition, in English it would always be the same. So there really is no accusative case. So horse, the horse ran, and the horse had run. I'm not putting it at the end, but trying to. Or of horses, of the horse, okay? The noun in English doesn't change, whether it's nominative, and that's why we don't have an accusative case in English. And genitive case, used to indicate a word we have the objective case, I think is what we call it in English, but the form of the word doesn't change. The genitive case, used to indicate a word in the possessive form, which is in English horses with apostrophe s. The horse's saddle fell off. Indo-European had 6 verb tenses. Hebrew, on the other hand, contained only 2 tenses or aspects dealing with actions either completed or not completed. Germanic, likewise, reduced its number of tenses to 2, past and present. The other tenses in modern Germanic languages have developed out of combinations of these 2 original tenses. So we see here that Germanic is heavily influenced by Hebrew. Verb forms in the 2 language groups also contain similarities. The Hebrew verb kom, K-O-M, also spelled kam, K-A-M, K-U-M, and yikom, to arise, come forth, for example, compares favorably with modern English come, C-O-M-E, and came, C-A-M-E, Old English kuman, and the German kommen, K-O-M-M-E-N. There's your Germanic shift again. Kam gekommen, to come forth, arrive, arise. So here, I'm telling you right now, folks, that English and German and all the other Indo-European languages come directly from the Hebrew. You can see the Hebrew roots right here. Number 3, vocabulary. Perhaps the most convincing similarity between Hebrew and Germanic lies in their shared vocabularies. Linguists recognize that about 1/3 of all Germanic vocabulary is not Indo-European in origin. Well, actually it is, because Indo-European and Hebrew are the same. The Jews and the academics have got this wrong. And I proved this last time when I it went back to Genesis 10 to show you that all of the descendants of Aram were commonly understood to be Indo-Aryans. And of course, the Shemites created the Hebrews. So proving without any doubt that all of these people in Mesopotamia were in fact Aramites, Shemitic people, a part of whom are the Hebrews. Okay, that's the only difference, that some of them are Hebrews and they had a Hebrew dialect, but even there, Aramaic and Hebrew have always been related. Let's continue. These words can be traced back to the Proto-Germanic period of 700 to 100 BC, but not beyond. Significantly, these are the words that compare favorably in both form and meaning with the Hebrew vocabulary. Okay, let's repeat that. I want to impress upon your mind that German is a form of Hebrew, that English is a form of Hebrew, that Danish, Dutch, Norwegian, French, etc., etc., Icelandic, are all forms of Hebrew with dialectical changes that have come about over, well, in the case of the first and second shifts, over 700 years apart. And a similar time period, maybe 500 years apart, and the fact that the third wave was primarily over land, you can understand why these three waves of Israelites have differing dialects of Hebrew. All of them, though, are in fact based on the Hebrew. Okay, so he says, these words can be traced back to the Proto-Germanic period of 700 to 100 BC, but not beyond. Well, that's about when the Israelites were there. Significantly, these are the words that compare favorably with both form and meaning in the Hebrew vocabulary. Once a formula was developed for comparing Germanic and Hebrew vocabulary, the number of similar words identifiable in both languages quickly reached into the thousands. Not just one or two, into the thousands. According to this formula, words brought into Germanic after 700 BC had a tendency to modify their spelling in three ways. This is an outstanding example of what linguistics is all about and how you can use linguistics to trace back in time the origins of the changes in dialects. First, in most Germanic dialects, the words change in spelling according to the sound shift, which we already established here. And if a consonant is in the middle of a word and the pronunciation of the the A, or if it's an E, the short vowel in front of it, if it's short, then they double the consonant between the two vowels, between the previous vowel and the following vowel. So Gimmel, G-I-M-M-E-L. And so you have words like that, whereas if it's a long sound, then they retain a single consonant between the vowels. That's what he's trying to tell us here, the doubling. Okay, so on the other hand, Hebrew, on the other hand, changed only in pronunciation. Spelling remained the same. For example, Hebrew para, to bear oneself along swiftly to travel, remained para when written, but it was pronounced fara if it was preceded by a closely associated long vowel. With that in mind, it is easy to recognize the same word in Old Norse and Old Frisian, a dialect in the Netherlands, fara, to travel or move swiftly. And of course, if you travel far enough, okay, you probably get the word far, fara. Second, the vowels in the initial symbols were frequently dropped in written Germanic forms because Hebrew words usually carried the accent on the last syllable. Compare Hebrew darak, and English drag. Occasionally, if the initial consonant was weak, the entire syllable dropped out, as in Hebrew alad, male offspring son, and English. You know how to apply the rule? You drop the initial consonant or an initial syllable. Walad in Hebrew becomes lad in English. And in Hebrew, nafal to fall, and English fall. Are you getting the picture, folks? That English and German are derived from Hebrew? They certainly are. Third, Hebrew used a tonal accent, a vocal emphasis featuring a tone or sound in part of a word, rather than a stress accent, a vocal emphasis featuring increased volume and speaking part of a word. But this changed to the stress accent in the Germanic dialects. This changed to a stress accent in the Germanic dialects. However, the effects of the Hebrew tonal accent are evident in Germanic. The Hebrew tone, we need some examples here, which usually appeared in the final syllable, was often represented in written Germanic by one of four tonal letters, L, M, N, or R. Compare Hebrew satat, to place, found, base, begin, with the English start. R represents the Hebrew tone, and Hebrew parak, to be free, to liberate, with English frank. Free, free speech, in which P was shifted to F. The unaccented A was deleted, and N was added for the Hebrew tone. So he's got this worked out to a science, folks, how the original Hebrew changed and was adapted by Germanic and obviously English, which is a derivative of both Germanic and Hebrew. Third, Hebrew used a tonal accent, a vocal emphasis featuring a tone or sound in part of a word, rather than a stress accent, a vocal emphasis featuring increased volume in speaking part of a word. But this changed to a stress accent in the Germanic dialects. However, the effects of the Hebrew tonal accent are evident in Germanic. The Hebrew tone, which usually appeared in the final syllable, was often represented in written Germanic by one of four tonal letters, L, M, N, or R, which, I just read this. Okay, so I don't need to go through that again. And then at the end here, in which P was shifted to F, the unaccented was A was deleted, and N was added for the Hebrew tone. So he's got this down to a science how the Hebrew characteristics changed the English and the Germanic. Okay, now he's going to give us some words. And we have a few minutes left, and I'm just going to start reeling off these words. And that will conclude our study for today. Some Hebrew-English cognates. Hebrew, kalal, or kahala, meaning to call. And the English word is, of course, call. Ober, to cross over. Now, this is same as German. Hebrew is ober. German is ober. English is over with a V. Hebrew, door or dur, to rotate, turn aside, enter a dwelling, becomes door. So, door in Hebrew is a verb. And in English becomes a noun, door, and the Germanic is Tür, T-U with an umlaut R. Door or Dur, Tür, and door. Gadar, Hebrew, to surround, enclose, collect. This one's, if you know about the shift, it becomes gather. Hebrew, harap or harapa, to pluck a harp, to harp at, to scold. And, of course, in English, harp. Darag, daraga, to go by steps, to walk or ascend with difficulty. Drop the first A in darag, and you get drag. Hebrew, balak, bilek, or blik, to make empty, void, black in English, void of light, bleak in English, void of vegetation, or to become pale, bleach, void of color, blank. Hebrew, shapa, to form, carve, shape, create. In English, becomes shape. So now you can see how English is directly derived from Hebrew. And I think it was Tyndale who said that the similarity between English and Hebrew is so great that when I translate directly from Hebrew into English, I don't even have to change the syntax of the sentence. All I have to do is substitute English words for Hebrew words, and the sentences make perfect sense. There's only one possible cause for such a result, folks, and that is because English retains Hebrew grammar. This is not true of any other language. English is derived from Hebrew, and since English is a derivative of Germanic, English, Hebrew, and Germanic are essentially the same, with Hebrew being the source for both. One more area here. We've got less than a minute and a half left. Biblical Hebrew contained relatively few root words, originally only a few hundred, but from these roots, words were formed in great variety. Most of these formations were made by exchanging vowels, adding prefixes or suffixes, and doubling consonants according to certain rules. Literally thousands of words similar to these roots and to the multiple forms that developed out of these roots appeared in Germanic dialects between 700 and 400 BC. One example is the Hebrew word for done, or don, D-U-N or D-O-N. The root is D-W-N and is related to the root Adon, to rule, to judge, to send, etc., area of domain. The proper name Dan, to judge, is the origin of these English and Germanic words. So, folks, don't believe these secular linguists. Don't believe the Jews. If you're a Caucasian, you're of Hebrew heritage and or Aramaic heritage. The latter is referred to as Indo-Aryan. The other is referred to falsely as Jewish. But it is Israelite. The Israelites were Hebrews, and the Hebrews and Aramaeans were cousins, and their languages were cousins of each other. That's the fact, folks. The linguists have it all wrong. We in identity know what we're talking about, and these people have, because they falsely have adopted Jewish reasoning, falsely believing the Jews to be Hebrews when they're not. That's why they have this all wrong. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. See you next time.